When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jeg tenkte på å ta på meg en dressjakke, men så tenkte jeg nei.
Ja, altså jeg var i akkurat samme tankerekken som deg, Kristina. Jeg lurte på, skal jeg ta på meg en dress i dag, eller skal jeg bare kjøre normalt? Men det jeg har gjort da, jeg har skjorta ned i buksa. Det ikke alltid jeg har det, men i dag, liksom for å pynte meg litt ekstra, så
gjorde jeg det. Er veldig stilig. Faktisk er det Ulla som har pyntet sin mester i dag, tror jeg.
Ja, og jeg fikk jo meg bare for selfie i dag.
Det glemte vi.
Og Kristina, jeg synes jo minst du kunne ha tatt skjorta ned i buksa.
Ja, det sant. Jeg har en sånn undertrøye som kommer utenfor, men...
Men hvorfor snakker dere om de klærne da?
Jo, altså vi har jo fått storfint besøk i dag.
Ja.
Og det som skal sies, hvis vi hadde møtt ham på hans hjembane...
Ja.
Altså hvis han er en amerikansk politiker på besøk i Norge, hvis vi hadde vært på en amerikansk ambassaden og møtt ham, da hadde vi jo pyntet oss begge to.
Da hadde vi tatt på oss dressjakker.
Ja, minst. Ja.
Minst en dressjakke.
Og kanskje du også hadde tatt skjorten i buksa?
Kanskje.
Velkommen på ordentlig til denne ukens episode av Aftenpodden USA. Jeg heter Kristoffer Rønneberg, med meg i studio Kristina Pletten. Hei igjen.
Hallo, Kristoffer Rønneberg.
Hei. Og grunnen til at vi snakker om å pynte oss og denne gjesten vi har, det vi kan kanskje fortelle litt mer i og med at vi snart skal begynne å snakke med ham. Han heter Jim Gerlach og tidligere politiker, altså han republikaner og satt i et distrikt i Pennsylvania og representerte dette distriktet i representantenes hus i 12 år.
Mm. Og bare sånn for å minne på dette for 100 gang så jo dette da to kamre i kongressen, det ene senat og representantens hus, og i representantens hus så det en person som representerer et distrikt, mens i senatet så representerer de hele delstaten. Så det var dagens lille leksjon.
Ja, ja. Så i huset så var det 435 personer, ja. Og i senatet det 100.
Ja, og de som sitter i representantens hus, de har jo da et distrikt som på rundt sånn 750,000 mennesker, de fleste av dem.
Ja. Og det som gjør Jim Gerlach så interessant, eller en av de tingene, at han liksom en sånn utdøende art i amerikansk politikk.
Svartelistet, rødlistet. Ja. Ja, rødlistet, er det vel.
Eller får vi bruke en annen farge, han litt sånn lilla, altså en blanding av rødt og blått. Altså han i midten av det politiske spektret i et amerikansk politisk system som hvor den røde og den blå siden dras lenger og lenger fra hverandre, så har han vært en type som forsøkte å finne en plass i midten sammen med folk fra demokratisk side. Og det fantes en tid i verden da det var lettere å gjøre enn akkurat nå. Så det litt spent på hva han tenker om den verden han levde i det politiske USA i Washington og hva vi ser i dag.
Ja, han var jo satt jo i kongressen helt til egentlig Trump begynte å gjøre seg gjeldende i amerikansk politikk. Så han har jo vært med på liksom innspurten med Tea Party-bevegelsen og alt det der, og det blir spennende å få hans perspektiv på hvor langt partiet og egentlig amerikansk politikk har beveget seg vekk fra det han kjente for bare 10-12 år siden.
Mm. Og så har vi jo her i studio akkurat nå, så Congressman Jim Gerlach, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're thrilled to have you here, and not least because you have 12 years of experience from the House of Representatives. You were there representing a district in Pennsylvania for 12 years from 2003 till 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, we've all seen the building, the Congress building, we're familiar with that. Some of us have been inside it. But you've been there working for 12 years. If you were to give us a tidbit of a story from behind the scenes, so is there something that you experienced there that we might not have expected to hear from the House?
Well, it was a wonderful experience, very educational. You learn more about issues that you could ever imagine, no matter what your walk of life is. Before you got elected to Congress and started serving, it's amazing the amount of issues and types of issues from a policy standpoint you work on, and it's very educational. And of course, you meet people from all around the country of all different types of backgrounds, political persuasions, vocations, and so you learn a lot from them. So it's and great staff. What you find too is really great staff people in Congress and on the executive branch side as well. So it's just very educational and very exciting to go down each week to work with your colleagues. Doesn't mean there's not a lot of separation of opinion on various policies, and sometimes it's very hard to get things done. And that, in turn, causes some people after a number of terms to say, you know, I've had enough and I want to go back to my home state and what I did before. So you're losing people. This year, there's a number of members of the House and Senate that aren't running for re-election for a number of reasons, including not a lot getting done. But that's the nature of our process, too, and how it's structured. And so bottom line, it was a wonderful experience. The first pinch me moment was the first State of the Union address by, in my case, President Bush, Bush 43. And having been elected that prior November, and then in January, listening to the State of the Union that year, it was, again, a pinch me moment. Couldn't believe I'm sitting here on the House floor with the president at the podium listening to his address. And so it caused you to think about, you know, your life and how you got to that point. But on a day-to-day basis, most of the people are wonderful people, both sides of the aisle. Most of the people are serious legislators. They want to see things accomplished. Unfortunately, I think there's far too many now legislators that are more political performers than they are serious legislators, but that's just the nature of politics right now in our country, and maybe other countries too. But it was a wonderful experience, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
You're talking about day-to-day operations, and I'm wondering, if you were to explain to, like, say, an 11-year-old, if he asks you, what is it that you actually do? You're 400-something representatives. What does your day look like? What is your job?
Well, the job is really you wear two hats. One is being a legislator. So you go to Washington each week to work on legislation, vote on legislation, and then you come home back to the district at the end of the week and then work in your district on issues that your constituents have. When I was in the House, we had about 720,000 people in our congressional districts. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty diverse group of citizens and communities. So in my district, outside the city of Philadelphia, in the suburbs of Philadelphia, I had very affluent areas. I had suburban-type communities, bedroom communities as a term, and had very rural areas, Amish farms and other types of agriculture. So you would, you know, move around your district when you're home, trying to understand problems, trying to understand issues, and helping your constituents with problems they may have with the federal government. So it might be a senior citizen that didn't get his or her Social Security check each month. And so where's my check? I need that to help live on. Or it might be a fire company, volunteer fire company, that didn't get some financial support from the emergency services program. Or might be a community that's waiting to get some money from the Federal Department of Commerce to help with an economic development project. So the other hat that you wear is helping your constituents and helping your communities with problems they have with the federal government. You're their advocate before the federal government. So you're always working, your staff's working to try to help them with their problems. So those are the two hats you wear. One is a legislator, voting on legislation, and the other working on behalf of your constituents with the day-to-day problems that they have.
When you try to solve people's problems they have with the federal government, that means you have to sort of respect the federal government and believe in it as a system. And now we have a Congress where a lot of people don't seem to see the need for for that kind of federal system. Is that one of the things that are making Congress more difficult as an institution when it comes to effectiveness?
Well, the federal government's grown so much over the past couple decades that while as an individual member, you and your staff have to work with the executive branch and getting problems resolved, that doesn't mean you don't see a lot of redundancy in the executive branch, a lot of programs that trip all over each other, a lot of wasteful dollars, a lot of misdirected funding that happens. And then you try in the appropriations process each year to address that as part of the appropriations bills that move through Congress. So you try to put language in the appropriations bill, let's say, with the Veterans Administration or with the Department of Defense or whatever federal agency, to try to correct some of those inefficiencies. And sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not. But when you and your staff work on problems for your constituents, you do then identify areas where there needs to be much more efficiency, and more dollars doesn't necessarily mean better government. In fact, it might result in a government bureaucracy that's not as responsive as it should be.
But I'm getting at more the Tea Party when it started in 2010. You were still in Congress, and mm-hmm. and the movement that came out of that. It's more about tearing down the federal system and not really recognizing it and trying to move away from it. Has that made it more difficult to operate in Congress? Do you think?
You know, my experience when I was in the House and the Tea Party movement really started. It wasn't. There were some angry people as part of the Tea Party movement, but it was more a movement towards how do we make government more responsive. How do we make government less bureaucratic? How do we make it less wasteful? That's really what most of the Tea Party folks were after. They weren't angry people. There were some angry people, but it wasn't the majority, at least in my experience, in my district. And I still think that sentiment feeds a lot of what's going on in our politics today. That year after year, election after election, president after president, Congress after Congress, they're still not addressing our debt crisis in the United States. They're not addressing a lot of the inefficiencies in government. They're not addressing, for example, the border security problem that exists. And so that's a lot of the frustration. And then at times that moves from frustration to anger for some. But that Tea Party movement really was, I think, the start and the foundation of what we're seeing today in our politics. And it's just the continuing frustration that government's not becoming more responsive, it's continuing to be less responsive, spends too much and doesn't get enough done. And that's some of the voting base right now that's in our electorate.
You were known as a moderate Republican. Mm-hmm. You spoke a lot about working across the aisle, mm-hmm. Finding solutions, being pragmatic. Mm-hmm. Is there space for that in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, Congresswoman Betsy Markey is with me on this trip, and a Democrat, and we were chatting a little bit earlier this morning on how even when we were there, it seems to be more vitriolic. It seems to be more anger-filled legislative sessions, and again, I think that's a reflection of the electorate itself, because people are, regardless of what your issue is, just seem to be more angry and more frustrated. And so I think that it's even worse of an environment right now to be in Congress than it was when we were there. It just seems there are not as many serious legislators as there were. And there were a few when I was there that weren't very serious. But they're still the great majority of House and Senate members, I think, are serious legislators. But they do have different ideologies and they have different points of view on policy. And so how can they work together to ultimately find a solution that gets you 218 votes in the House, gets you 60 in the Senate, because we still have a filibuster rule. So you need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. And then, of course, a president that'll sign that into law. So the formula hasn't changed. It's still you need 218, 60, and 1 to get the policies you want accomplished. And so it's a little more difficult right now, given the makeup of the Congress and the White House, but that's why you have elections every 2 years.
Of course, I have to ask, though, when you say that you've said twice now there are non-serious actors in Congress.
On both sides of the aisle.
Who are you referring to?
Well, just read social media and read the newspaper accounts, and their names will come glaringly out to you. And again, it's on both sides of the aisle. So I'm sorry, I didn't really answer your last question. So the moderate faction, there seems to be a smaller group. When I was there, on the Republican side, we were known as the Tuesday group because we'd get together on Wednesday mornings, and we couldn't figure out why we were called the Tuesday group if we're always getting together on Wednesday mornings for breakfast. But it was about 40, 45 moderate Republican members. And then you had the Blue Dog Democrats. They would get together every week, and it was about the same number, 40 to 50 Blue Dog Democrats. And then we would work together, Blue Dog Democrats and Tuesday Group Republicans, and we would have the ability to try to get some amendments and move certain legislation. And then the rest of the 435 members of the House were far-right Republicans or far-left Democrats. Today, that moderate faction is much smaller. There's probably only realistically about 20 to 25 moderate Republicans based on their districts, political districts. And I think last time I saw the Blue Dog Democrat caucus is only 10 members. It was 40 or 50. Betsy Markey remembered it to be 50 or 53. So it's just a fewer number of moderate districts. And when we say moderate district, a district that in any given election cycle could go Democrat or could go Republican, depending on who the candidates are and what the issues they're running are, versus very strongly Republican districts and very strongly Democrat districts that no matter who runs that particular year, it's going to stay Democrat or it's going to stay Republican. So, there are fewer moderate districts, and it just makes it even harder to get to that 218 because the others are dug in pretty solidly on their positions on various issues. So it's hard to move them off those points of view and get them towards the middle to get 218 votes. And that's what's making it much more difficult to get consensus on the big issues. Now, there's legislation passed every week when they're in session on a bipartisan basis, and people don't see that much in the media. But there's a lot of bipartisan legislation, but it's not the big issues. When I say big issues, Social Security, Medicare, border security, health care.
Well, they did also infrastructure.
Yeah, they did transportation infrastructure. That usually gets a bipartisan support. And there are some appropriations bills that are pretty bipartisan, like a farm bill, agricultural bill. But other policy issues, it's very, very challenging to get to 218 with the makeup of the House and the Senate right now.
I just have to ask you, because what you're describing really is a machine for polarization. Stemming from partly how the electoral system is put together. And it seems to me that you have a system now where a big chunk of the electorate really is in the center. There are moderates on both sides. And then you have the political parties sort of moving to the right or to the left, which is basically what you're describing. How do you find representation for those people in the middle when you have a system that's pulling apart like that? And maybe Nikki Haley's voters is a good example. Mm-hmm. Where do they go? Do you need a third party? What can you do about this?
Well, we're going to see. There may be at least one third party candidate for president this year. It might be a few third party candidates that can have a really big impact on the final election results between President Biden and President Trump. But in congressional districts, what you need to keep in mind is congressional districts are reformed every 10 years after the census is taken, because there are some districts that gain a lot of population, some districts that lose population. So you have to even those back out again. But it's the states that do that, the state legislatures that do that. And of course, depending on who's in charge in the state legislature, if it's a Republican state legislature, they're going to try to redraw those congressional districts in that state as favorably to Republicans as possible. And then the flip also is true in Democrat states. So over time, a lot of these districts have become much, much more Republican or much more Democrat. And it's harder to get more moderate folks elected in those districts because they are so far right or so far left. That's a real challenge for our system. And so if I'm living in a really, really strong Republican district or a strong Democrat district, but I'm more center, you know, my voice isn't really going to be heard necessarily because a more conservative or a more liberal person is going to get elected in that district, you know, regardless of what my vote is. So there's going to have to at some point, I think, to address that issue that you're talking about, there's going to have to be some constitutional reform to even out the process for how districts are formed every 10 years. But with that said, I also think eventually the American public are going to have to realize character means a lot in terms of who's getting elected. And we have to elect people based upon their honesty, their integrity, their points of view as well, but not just go for the political performers that, you know, every day try to get their name on social media and try to fundraise off that and try to get their name in the newspaper and say, look what a great job I'm doing, when in fact, you're not contributing to any policy solutions at all because you always vote no on everything. So we've got some electoral processes, challenges that we're going to have to address at some point to make sure ultimately there's as much opportunity to get good, common sense minded people elected as possible.
I just have to stick in a little question because you mentioned a third party candidate. Do you think No Labels will run a candidate, and who can that be?
It's very hard to say because some of those that were talked about as being a No Labels candidate have withdrawn their names.
Yeah. Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin is one. Nikki Haley has said she doesn't want to run. Larry Hogan was governor of Maryland. He was talked about for a long time, but he decided to run for the U.S. Senate seat that's open in Maryland this year.
Right.
So it's hard to imagine right now who that candidate would be for No Labels. And it's also hard to imagine they're only on, I think, about 17 state ballots right now. I think the more intriguing question is the Libertarian Party always puts a presidential candidate up and always gets on every state's ballot, whoever their candidate is. So what's going to be interesting is, does Robert F. Kennedy Jr., does he become their party's candidate, the Libertarian Party's candidate, and instantly have a ballot position in all 50 states? And if he does, then that's going to have a big impact on the election. Right now, he's only on one state ballot as an independent. He's in Utah.
Do you think he will pull voters away from the Republican or the Democrat?
Well,
party?
The polling right now, he'll pull from both, but the polling seems to be the average of the polling. He pulls a few more percentage points from President Biden than he does from President Trump. So in some state polls where Trump might be up 1-2 points after you insert Robert F. Kennedy's name and even a few other third parties, Trump then goes up by 4 or 5 points. So that suggests to me right now that he, Robert F. Kennedy, would pull a few more percentage points from President Trump. And that's why the Democratic Party is constantly challenging Kennedy's efforts to get on the ballot in more states. There's legal challenges in a lot of those states.
Just to go back to the gridlock in Congress, I mean, this was the main reason why you left Congress in 2014. And now we have a situation where there is hardly any laws being passed in the House. And the big issue right now is the question of Ukraine and trying to find a way to provide aid to Ukraine. Now, there's a bill passed in the Senate, $95 billion, and it's still being withheld in the House. Speaker Mike Johnson is struggling to find a way to get it onto the floor so that it can be debated. So he's come forward with a couple of suggestions, maybe get the Democrats to give something so that he can put it on the floor. The Democrats, they have to help him because he is, in effect, being held hostage by a small group of Republicans who can throw him out as Speaker at any point. Now, could you, with your insight from the House, how would you describe the situation that Speaker Mike Johnson is in right now? And is there a way out for him?
You said it very well. He's in a very, very tight spot legislatively and politically. He was made Speaker after Speaker McCarthy was thrown out by what's called a discharge petition that only a few members of the House Republican Conference introduced. And as a result, Speaker McCarthy was kicked out of the speakership. And after weeks and weeks, House Republicans got Mike Johnson from Louisiana to become the Speaker. The problem with the Ukraine funding from a House Republican standpoint is there's a significant minority of members in the House Republican Conference that want to tie Ukraine and Israeli funding support to the border security problem we have in the United States. We've had now anywhere from 8 to 10 million illegal migrants come across mostly the southern border, a little bit of the northern border, but mostly the southern border. And it's just it's a huge problem domestically. And so they've taken the position, why should we support Ukraine with their border issue with Russia while we can't take care of our own problem domestically on the southern border?
But sir, there was a package passed that they decided not to support.
Well, what happened was they tried to negotiate a resolution.
They negotiated
of that
for months,
in the Senate.
Right.
But ultimately, the package that one senator from Oklahoma, Senator Lankford, negotiated with the Senate Democrat majority just wasn't palatable to most Republicans. Had too many loopholes, had wouldn't really address the problem.
Was that really the issue, though?
Yeah, there were some problems. There were some problems.
Because the reports in the media were basically that Donald Trump was behind stopping his package and if you read
the language of the legislation, there were significant problems with it.
So it's something that you wouldn't have voted for?
Well, I don't know what I would have done with it, frankly, because I didn't really get into all the specifics of the legislation. But what I can tell you is, for example, it would have allowed the continuation of 5,000 people to come across the southern border every day without the president having to do anything with that. So that's 1.8 million illegal immigrants that we come across without having to do anything a year. That was not a sufficient response for some Republicans. It would change the definition of the grounds for which you could declare asylum for persecution purposes. It would have not stopped the catch and release process in place right now, where if you came across illegally, you have to be let out somewhere into the country. You're not sent back to where you came from. So there were a lot of Republicans who felt that the legislation, while it was a bipartisan effort in the Senate, still didn't get to the root problems of the system. So they said no, they didn't want to support that. With that said, in my view, the Ukraine funding still is out there. You can't, in my opinion, link Ukraine funding with the border security problem. They're two separate and distinct issues. And so if you're going to be responsible, you can't ignore the Ukraine issue while you say, well, we still haven't resolved the border security, so we can't do anything.
We should just mention here that you've been on the Ukraine caucus.
Yeah, I co-chaired the House Ukraine caucus when I was in there. So I worked on a lot of Ukraine-related issues during my time there. But I think just recently, in the past few days, Speaker Johnson has indicated his willingness, when the House returns to session next week, that he's going to move a Ukraine bill, regardless of whether there's any border security issues attached to it. And I think that's to his great credit. I think regardless of what it would take to get the bill to the floor, it's going to ultimately pass on a pretty wide bipartisan basis. Now, he may experience, if he does that, he may experience a lot of political fallout by some of those political performers I was talking about on the Republican side. And there may be an effort to do a discharge petition and remove him. But I think he's demonstrated a desire to lead now. And I think he's made some public comment that he wants to see a Ukraine bill pass because Ukrainians deserve that support right now. And I think he'll move that bill next week and hopefully it'll pass.
I'd like to ask, now that we've seen Donald Trump taking over the Republican Party more and more for the past, ever since he lost the presidency in 2020 as well, now he's in charge of the RNC as well. Would there have been room for a moderate Republican like yourself in Trump's Republican Party?
It would have been a lot harder, no doubt about it. I think both parties are changing significantly. The groups that make up the parties now are different than the groups, the coalition of voters that made up the party 20 years ago. The Republican Party is becoming a much more blue collar party. A lot more working class folks and even union folks are moving into the Republican column. That's different than the way it used to be. The voting blocks. Many more African-American voters are now voting Republican, Hispanic voters are Republican. Conversely, the Republicans were very popular in the suburbs, including the suburbs of Philadelphia. They're voting more Democratic. It's funny, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, grew up north of Pittsburgh. When I was growing up, very blue-collar, steel-making towns, very Democrat. In fact, my home county was 2-1 Democrat when I was growing up. And where I live now, Chester County, outside of Philadelphia, was 2-1 Republican. Now it's almost flipped. My hometown county, where I grew up, is now Republican. And Chester County, where I've lived and been elected to office, is now Democrat. So we're seeing both parties change significantly, and that's having big impact on elections, not only in Pennsylvania, but across the country. So we'll see where these changes in political demographics, where they're going to take us this election and in future elections for both Republican and Democrat parties.
It's really interesting to hear you say that. And when I hear you say it, I'm wondering, did the voters change the most or did the parties change the most? I mean, what precipitated this?
Probably a combination of both. Voters will ultimately support the candidates and the parties that they view understand the most and will do something about the problems they have. And so if you see certain voters moving from one party to the other, that's an indication they think that other party now understands them better. And so and that's been the history of political parties in the United States since our founding. Political parties ultimately that do have as broad of an appeal to as many voters as possible will be successful in elections. Remember, elections are all about addition, not subtraction or division. And so the party that understands that best every election cycle, that brings in more people across. And here's the other fact. Only about 27% of American voters are Republican, and only about 27% of American voters are Democrat. The others are 43% are independents. And then the rest, the other 3-4% are other, smaller parties. So really, if you're going to be successful in competitive races, you not only have to get at least 92% of your own party's voters, you have to get a significant, if not majority, of the independent vote. And so how do you appeal to those voters is important, not just your own party, but those independent voters. And whoever does that best is going to win the election.
All right. So I'll end with a very easy question. And speaking of competitive elections, who do you see as U.S. president a year from now?
In our prior meetings this morning, I can tell you, as what I said then, it is a coin toss right now. There's so many factors that have to play out to determine the winner that you just can't predict it. I can't predict it. And I think it's a coin toss. So many factors are going to come into play. Third-party candidates, what happens with Donald Trump's court cases, what happens with those voters that don't want President Trump or Biden to even be the nominees. What do they do? Do they stay home or do they vote, and who do they vote for? All those factors are going to roll in together that are going to determine ultimately the last one or two states that will determine the presidency.
So just one last little question, because I think the voters that you described there are also the voters that you know maybe the best, the swing voters, the suburban voters. What's going to be important for them in this election, and how do you think they're going to split their votes?
Well, they all have different issues that really excite them. In the suburbs, I think the abortion issue is going to be really important for a lot of suburban women. Again, this year, as it was in the election 2 years ago, that's going to drive them. But then there will be others where the economy and inflation is the issue. There'll be others where immigration is the issue. So there's different issues that appeal to different sets of voters that then really stimulate their interest in participating in the process. And so when you throw all that together, that's going to determine who wins that election in Pennsylvania or Michigan or Georgia. And those are going to be the kinds of states that ultimately decide the outcome of the Electoral College.
Congressman Jim Gerlach, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Ja, Kristina, nå har den tidligere kongressmannen forlatt Aftenposten bygget. Det var jo interessante tanker han kom her.
Ja, det var det, for så vidt. Jeg synes han var litt mer optimistisk enn hva jeg kanskje hadde forventet da. Veldig mange er jo veldig pessimistiske etter hvert om USAs politiske fremtid.
Ja, var han optimistisk, eller var han diplomatisk og ville ikke si noe som var liksom,
ja.
Gærent?
Ja, kanskje litt begge deler. Men han malte i hvert fall ikke en sånn helt katastrofalt bilde da. Mm. Det kan han kanskje heller ikke gjøre, men Jeg synes jo kanskje det mest interessante han sa var det som kom frem på slutten her med at der han oppvokst og der han var representant har nesten switchet plass I det, på det politiske spektrum. Altså han vokste opp på et sted som var demokratisk, så nå har blitt republikansk, og mens I den forstaden som han representerte, så blir de mer og mer demokratiske da.
Mm.
Det spennende altså.
Ja, det gjør det jo vanskelig også å forutse hva folk kommer til å stemme på, hvilke retning de går I nå nå I november.
Ja, og så synes jeg det andre som var veldig spennende jo egentlig dette her med trepartskandidat som jeg hele tiden har tenkt kommer til, det gjør dette her valget så utrolig uforutsigbart. Og det han egentlig sa nå var jo at det kan komme en surprise, sånn som jeg hørte det.
Og kanskje det Robert Kennedy, kanskje noen andre? Kanskje det din heltinne Nikki Haley som, som melder seg som tredjepartikandidat?
Nei, det tror jeg ikke. Jeg tror ikke det. Men, men han, han antyder jo at det et stort rom der da, og det det jo. Ikke sant? Det en kjempestor mulighet her for å, om ikke vinne valget, så I hvert fall på en måte styre de I den retningen en tredje kandidat vil. Kennedy ser jo ut til å, han kritiserer egentlig Biden mye mer enn han gjør Trump. Jeg så et intervju med han bare for en dag eller to siden der han sa at Biden var mye farligere presidentkandidat enn Trump var, farligere for Amerika. Så det egentlig ganske tydelig hvor han vil han da. Han en mann som kan bli ganske farlig for Biden.
Det som helt sikkert at vi må følge med på Pennsylvania I november og før november for å se hva som skjer der, for det kan jo virkelig bli utslagsgivende for resultatet I presidentvalget. Men det jo fortsatt en stund til november, og I mellomtiden så skal vi reflektere over mye rart og snakke om mye rart. Har du tenkt litt på noe spesielt den siste uken for vår runde med obligatorisk refleksjon?
Ja, så jeg skal komme med en ren anbefaling som også jeg føler jeg har blitt litt smartere av for a change. Og det en bok som heter Doppelganger av Naomi Klein, en amerikansk forfatter. Unnskyld, kanadisk hun vel, men litt sånn amerikansk-kanadisk.
Hun som hadde No Logo, var det ikke det?
Hun som har skrevet boket No Logo. Og hvis du tenker nå, ja, ikke det også en som heter Naomi Wolf, jo det det, som har skrevet en bok som heter The Beauty Myth, og folk skjønner ikke at dette to forskjellige personer da, for det to jødiske kvinner som ganske smarte og skrevet gode bøker, og heter Naomi begge to. Og så har det skjedd at Naomi Wolf, som feminist, og egentlig var veldig sånn markant og kjent på slutten av 90-tallet, begynnelsen av 2000-tallet, hun har blitt helt koko. Og blitt sånn, sitter på Steve Bannon sitt talkshow og spyr ut konspirasjonsteorier. Og så tror folk at det Naomi Klein. Så de klarer ikke å skille her. Så har hun skrevet en bok om dette her. Og, men som også ser...
om det var en dobbeltgjenger? Eller
om det å ha en gal dobbeltgjenger. Men også liksom hvordan hele... Trump-bevegelsen blitt en slags sånn rar dobbeltgjenger for venstresiden. Så at, altså, de har tatt en del av tematikkene, av retorikken, ordene, metodene som venstresiden egentlig har brukt. For eksempel å kritisere big business, ikke sant? Eller krigsmaskineriet. Og litt sånn tilbake til det Gellok sa, så jo dette også da en av årsakene til at mange såkalte blue collar workers eller arbeiderklassevelgere skifter side. Så hun går liksom ganske dypt inn I hele denne her bevegelsen I USA og ser på også sånne popkulturelle trender, og det en kjempeinteressant bok. Så ja, absolutt verdt å anbefale. Så kommer hun til Norge I mai.
Oi?
Ja.
Naomi Wolf eller Naomi Klein?
Jeg vet ikke Naomi Wolf.
Naomi Campbell.
Naomi Campbell. Hun ble også av og til, hun ble også av og til forvekslet med Naomi Campbell.
Ja.
Og da måtte hun si sånn med en gang hun kom inn sånn at ja, jeg vet dere forventer en supermodell, men sorry.
Ja, folk må lære seg at folk kan ha samme fornavn uten å være samme person. Ja. Det må være mulig for
meg. Men den I hvert fall morsom og god og tankevekkende, så ja.
Nei, men det kanskje vi kan gå på det eventet og se på Naomi Klein.
Ja,
du og jeg sammen.
Kanskje vi kan få en til å bli gjest på podden.
Ja, det må jeg prøve på.
Ja, så snill. Naomi Klein.
Ja, men det var en god refleksjon. Jeg har reflektert rundt noe som jeg generelt følger mye med på. Og det er denne situasjonen som utfører seg mellom Kina og USA. Altså verdens to største supermakter som forsøker å unngå det som heter Tukidide-fellen, oppkalt etter en gresk historiker som snakket om konflikten mellom Sparta og Aten, og som generelt handler om hva en framvoksende stormakt gjør med den eksisterende stormakten og omvendt. Altså, er det mulig for Kina å vokse uten å komme i konflikt med den eksisterende stormakten USA? Og der har jo ting nå i årevis gått i veldig, veldig gæren retning.
Ja.
Og det begynte med Trump, og så har det fortsatt for full gass under Biden. Men nå, den siste uken, så er det noen få lyspunkter. Det var en gruppe med amerikanske businessfolk i Beijing nå i påsken. Og lederne på begge sider har begynt å snakke litt sånn andre ordelag enn før. Så jeg tror det er tendenser nå til at de har skjønt at dette her bærer mot en full kollisjon, og at både Xi Jinping og Joe Biden er veldig opptatt av å unngå det, ikke bare sånn retorisk, men at de faktisk ser at dette kan gå så ille at det virkelig skjærer seg. Så nå er det en ordlyd der som er ny, og det er veldig interessant, og jeg tenker litt oppløftende å se at de nå ser ut til å prøve i hvert fall å unngå denne kollisjonen. Så det er en sånn føljetong som bare er å følge med på videre, men akkurat nå ser det ut til at forholdet mellom disse to stormaktene er bedre enn de har vært på kanskje, skal ikke si mange år, men kanskje en god stund i hvert fall.
Så de skal ikke kalle hverandre for sånn ondskapens rike og fiende og sånne ting, eller?
Nei, ikke foreløpig. Og så er det masse skjær i sjøen, også bokstavelig talt i sjøen, ja. Både i Taiwan-stredet og
i good one.
Og i disse skjærene som er i Sør-Kina-havet, så er det, ja, Filippinene driver og utkjemper små sjøslag med Kina for tiden, hvor kystvakten fra begge landene driver og krasjer inn i hverandre og dynker hverandre med vannkanoner og sånt. Og det er klart, hvis Kina og Filippinene går til konflikt sammen, så kan USA bli innblandet der. Men alt dette her er liksom ting som kan skje, men det man konkret forsøker å gjøre noe med nå, det er det direkte forholdet mellom disse to statene, og der har det skjedd ting den siste måneden, de siste ukene, som tyder på at de tar dette alvorlig, at de prøver å jobbe med det. Så får vi se om det er nok til å unngå denne Tukidide-fellen da.
En liten positiv ord.
Ja, det er lov å håpe.
Ja.
Ja. Og med det så kan vi si takk for denne gangen. Spennende samtale med kongressmannen. Takk til deg, Kristina Pletten. Takk til produsent Ulla Rafaelsen. Vår ansvarlig redaktør heter Trine Eilertsen. Jeg heter Kristoffer Rønneberg. Og med det så sier jeg bare takk for i dag, og vi snakkes i neste uke.
Hæ? Veldig bra.
I Poprådet denne uka har vi hatt besøk av Torbjørn Røe Isaksen.
I ain't no hullebekk, girl.
Vi har snakket om country Beyoncé.
Jeg sier bare at jeg synes det var litt kjedelig.
Helt enig.
Prinsesse Kate.
Burde vi ikke få litt dårlig sammen?
Shakira om Barbie.
Dra til Las Vegas.
Fra The Bear til The Boss.
Det er god casting, men...
Og så er vi nede i den høykulturelle pornokjelleren.
Sprukken hud og vonde tær og flass.
Nikotinefingre og der, ja.
Hør Poprådet i Aftenposten-appen eller hos Podme.